everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our daily coverage of the 2019 Iditarod here on Dog Works Radio. And joining me from Anchorage, Alaska, is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. We are in the middle of what looks like it's going to be a very exciting and very, very competitive race. And, you know, it always is every year, but it seems like there are a bunch of teams who are competing in this year's Iditarod who really feel like...
I agree with you. As we are talking today, a lot of teams will be getting ready to take their 24-hour mandatory rest, and we can talk about that in just a second. But, man, those guys and gals are blazing the trail, aren't they? Most of them are through sort of the most difficult sections of the trail, including the Happy River Steps and the Dazzle Gorge, and some of them are through what they call the Farewell Burn. All of the areas that many people think are the toughest parts, not many people are having too many issues with those, are they?
No, and it's nice, but it also is a little bit surprising that we have not yet seen any scratches in this race. And ordinarily by this time, on Tuesday, we're recording this Tuesday afternoon, there would have been one or two scratches in the past. But we are really kind of burning up the trail. Nick Petit just got into McGrath a little while ago, and I believe will win the Spirit of Alaska Award for doing that. Your Olsom, who was last year's champion, the defending champion, is just about 6 miles out of McGrath, 6 miles until he gets to McGrath. And then I'm looking at the tracker, and Jesse Royer, Pete Kaiser, Ali Zirkel, Matt Hall, Ryan Reddington, Travis Beals, and Richie Deal are not too far behind. So it's a lot of people who, I think it's fair to say that any of those people that I just named could go on to win this race.
Are you seeing, as we're talking, I guess this would be day three of the official race. The race started on Sunday. Are you seeing any surprises so far? I know you watched this on the tracker with the GPSs and all that. Are you seeing anything that either is really, really concerning or just a cool story about what's happening on the trail there?
You know, so far there's nothing that, in terms of the way teams are progressing, there's nothing yet that is – really shocking or that surprising. There are a bunch of teams that that I think are going to be making fairly big moves in the next day or two that are, kind of lurking at that behind the very front of the pack, but like right up there. And I'm talking about Mitch Seavey, who is about 30 miles, 35 miles behind the leader. Jeff King is a little bit further back, but is still in a position where I think he could make a move, but he has to make it pretty quickly if he's going to. Lance Mackey is pretty solidly in the middle of the pack, which is about where I think most people expected him to be. I love Lance Mackey, and I'm a big Lance Mackey fan, but given everything that's happened to him and all of that, it's not, I would love to see Lance Mackey win again, but it doesn't seem like that's in the cards right now. A lot of the rookies are, as you would expect, further back and, in the back of the pack. Cindy Galee, I believe, Galee, I always mispronounce
Galley.
Her name, so I apologize. Galley, of course. And Cindy Abbott are back towards the end of the teams, which is that they both have won multiple Red Lanterns. Cindy Abbott's won multiple Red Lanterns, and I think Cindy Galley has won one Red Lantern. So that's about where I'd expect them. But I have to say that it looks like, just from watching it and looking at all of the coverage and all of the insider videos and things like that, it looks like teams are doing very well. And as you mentioned, the first third of the race has those really difficult parts, the Dalzell Gorge and the Farewell Burn. And it seems like teams are performing fairly well through that area. So that's always a good thing. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are happy that we had the big dumps of snow that we've had relatively recently up here as well.
Right. I am recording this from a Starbucks coffee shop parking lot, as life has to happen around the podcast. And I'm sure you're a little bit more seated and centrally located than I. But the last time I checked, it looked like Anna and Christy Barrington were up to their old antics of traveling together as a group. Is that still where they're at now? I checked it this morning, and they were at the same spot.
Yeah, they are both resting, and I believe they are in a checkpoint. No, they're right outside of a checkpoint, but they're both stopped at the same mileage. So it looks like they are going to again be traveling together for most of the race, I would imagine.
You know, as a musher, that is a great way to work your way down the trail. If you're not competing to win, if you're just out to do a race or an expedition or anything like that, the comfort of having that ability to travel with somebody is an awesome experience. Not only can you help each other out if issues occur on the trail, you can also, hang out with them at the checkpoints and bounce ideas and problems and solutions off of each other. And I'm sure that, they do just about everything together out there in training and on the trail. I think that that's one heck of a team, don't you think?
I really do. And it seems like a lot of times as we're watching the races progress, those kind of groupings happen kind of naturally. There will be two or three teams that are traveling at approximately the same speed, and they will tend to travel fairly closely together. And for a while, one will lead and then for a while, the other will lead. And as you said, it's a nice way to, you're still each running your own race and going through it with your own dogs, but it's a nice way to have someone nearby in case something happens and you need some help or something like that. So I think that that's really cool. And I like that it pretty much happens, organically every single year.
Right. And talking about if something does happen, that is going to be our first story of the evening. Wow, what news broke earlier this morning with Linwood Fielder and Mats Pedersen. Would you like to share that story with our listeners?
Yeah, I'm looking at this story from KTVA, and apparently last night, Mats Pedersen said that he was coming down the trail, and 2 miles before he got to the Roan checkpoint, he just saw a headlight flashing, and he saw that it was Linwood Fiedler, and he didn't have his dog team with him, but he had his sled. So it was a musher and a sled, but no dogs. And apparently what happened is the line that connected his dogs to the sled broke. So the dogs ran off, probably a little bit faster, not having to pull the sled and the musher. And it's the middle of the night, and suddenly, Mats Pedersen picked up Linwood Fiedler, and they went looking for the dogs. And luckily, because it was night, they were able to see the dogs looking to various sides of the trail, and they were able to see the dogs who were a little bit off the trail together down on the river, and they were able to see them because at night, dogs' eyes are very reflective. And we saw that a lot when we were coming back from Yetna the other night, and there were a couple of dog teams that we encountered, and you could see these 24 eyes staring at, or 28 eyes staring at you from the dogs, which was almost in some cases as as striking as seeing the musher's headlamp. So they were saying that it was actually lucky for them, they think, that it was night when this happened, because if that hadn't been the case, they might not have been able to spot the dogs. But because it was night and the eyes are so reflective, they were able to stop the dogs, get the dogs together, and then Linwood was able to bring them back and hook them back up to his sled again. And when he came into the checkpoint a little bit after Mats Pedersen, he explained to the race judges that he had hit a stump and the line broke, and then he was saved, and his race was saved by Mats Pedersen. And we talk a lot on this show about how there's a there's an ethos in dog mushing that you help each other, and that you help a fellow musher when there are problems, and when they need help, especially when something has happened to their dogs, either a dog is sick or a dog has escaped, or in this case, an entire team has become separated from the sled. And that just strikes me as one of the coolest things about dog mushing, and it's something that I've always really, really enjoyed.
Yeah, and that is a scary situation. I think it's probably one of the most scary situations you can encounter as a dog musher. The first rule of mushing is always don't let go of the sled, and that is for this very reason. But in this case, either the line or the carabiner broke when Linwood went over that stump. And I tell you what, Alex, this has only happened to me one time in 24 years of dog mushing. And a little story here, my son and I, Tyler, were hooking up our dog team right in our yard, and it was an early fall run, and we had had them hooked up to the four-wheeler. And when we were running a 14-dog team, and we had hooked up 13 of the 14 dogs. And as Tyler was running up to hook up the last dog, the gangline snapped and took off down the road with him hanging on to a team of 13 dogs. Well, actually, it was 12 dogs running down the road towards the Parks Highway. And for folks that are not familiar with Alaska, the Parks Highway is the highway that runs north from Anchorage to Fairbanks and beyond. So it's a very busy road. So only thing that was going through my mind was here goes my team of 12 dogs running down the highway with my son dragging, hanging onto the gang line behind them. And I tell you what, my heart dropped when that happened. Not only were they heading to the highway, but if this happens in a race or in a training run by yourself, there's real danger that very quickly these dogs can become tangled. And that is a very dangerous situation for the dogs. There has been times where dogs were severely injured or killed because by the other dogs in the team because of this tangle. They're strangled. All sorts of things can happen. And it's just a miracle that Linwood's team was relatively unscathed from an event like this, because so many things can happen in such quick succession, and to have them just hanging out together along the river is just an amazing story. And I think that may be the story of this year's Iditarod. What do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely the story of the Iditarod so far. I mean, I hate to say it, but we still have a long way to go, and I'm sure there will be a lot of other amazing things that happen. But this is certainly it's one of those great kind of feel good stories in my mind anyway. And it's the kind of story that we love to focus on this show as well.
We have another feel-good story, but I want to come back to something you said as you were talking there, Alex, about the ethos of mushers and them taking care of each other. It seems like every year a story like this happens, whether it be Jim Lanier saved by Scott Jansen or Jason Mackey helping out his brother when he couldn't work with his dogs on the trail, or you know, the snow machiner finding Hugh Neff huddled up, you know, on the sea ice, or Allie and Jeff King and their predicament and safety a few years ago when he huddled his team up and just sort of started walking towards the checkpoint and Allie said, "Where's Jeff? You know, I'd seen him on the trail. Where is he at?" It just seems like every year there's one of these stories that breaks where another musher or another person that's involved with the race helps out another. And I think that's what makes this race and this sport so special. And one side note to that is a musher can help another person at any time during the race if there is a need, like the example we had with Matz and Linwood. But if outside assistance comes into play, whether it be a snow machine or a trail official or whatever, their race is over. The dog team that's on the trail's race is over. The musher is disqualified and has to withdraw. But in cases like this, this is allowed, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think also if there's a runaway dog team, I think that might be an exception where people are allowed to stop a dog team and tie the team to a tree, for example. I know mushers can definitely do that, and I'm not sure. Perhaps outside people can do that. I'll have to check the rules later on.
Right. So we also have a feel-good story of today, and that this also broke this morning. It was about a stray dog running around with a couple of mushers for several miles. I believe it was about 30 miles. What is that story about?
Right. So there's a dog who apparently is a dog who lives at or around the Winter Lake Lodge at Finger Lake. And, you know, there are a lot of dogs at these lodges and roadhouses and, you know, who belong to people who live there or live in the area. And a lot of times the dogs are a little bit more free to run around than, you know, your average indoor household pet type of dog. So this dog was there at Finger Lake, and teams were going through the checkpoint on Sunday evening, and the dog just decided, hey, that looks like fun, and he ran alongside the teams of Pete Kaiser and Ryan Reddington all the way from Finger Lake to Rainy Pass.
Rainy Pass, right.
Yeah, and, you know, people, we've heard a lot of people, especially people who are not that familiar with dog mushing, say that, you know, that the dogs are forced to run, which is, first of all, nonsense, because as you know very well, as any musher can tell you, when the dogs don't want to run, they just don't run, you know, and that's why it's so important not to overrun your dogs early in the race. And it's so important to make sure that the act of actually running and pulling the sled is enjoyable for the dogs, because otherwise the dogs will just stop. And not only is that true, that these dogs who were in harness love to run, but here's a dog who wasn't even in harness. Here's a dog who was like totally, you know, not a part of any team, just a regular dog who looked at these dogs and said, that looks like fun. I'm going to go with them. And then went with them for 30 miles. And that's that, you know, to put that in perspective, we're talking probably about a 3 hour or, you know, maybe 3 hour and 20 minute trip. So that's not, you know, a casual, I'm going to run with the car down to the stop sign type of thing. That's a pretty serious event. Ryan Reddington said that the dog was a really good looking dog, and he suspected that it might have shared some of the bloodlines from some of his grandfather, Joe Reddington Sr.'s dogs. So after they took care of the dog and fed the dog when it got to Rainy Pass, they put it on a plane, I assume an Iditarod Air Force plane, and flew it back to its home in Finger Lake. And I know I'm anthropomorphizing this a lot, but I've got to think that that dog, when it got back to Finger Lake, was just telling all of the other dogs, I had the best adventure this afternoon.
Yeah, I love that story. And he truly looked like a sled dog just from the picture I saw on Facebook. So as they say, sled dogs are born to run. And if a dog can just kind of pick himself up off the proverbial porch and take a 30-mile run with you know, little effort, that really shows the genetics of sled dogs. But, you know, I have a question. I'm sure it happened, but I assume that this dog ran with these two mushers. You had said that it was Pete Kaiser and Ryan Reddington. I wonder if this dog took the trail down the Happy River steps, you know, in between Finger Lake and Rainy Pass. What do you think about that?
It must have. It must have just, you know, it's probably a lot easier for, because we always say that that part of the trail is usually fine for the dogs. It's the mushers who are, you know, in danger there. It's the sleds that tip over and that sort of thing. But it must have been just a great time for that.
Yeah, what a cool story. Before we jump into our musher profile of the evening, I want to talk quickly about the 24-hour rest. I know a lot of people ask questions about that, especially new fans, and they're asking on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, why is, you know, XYZ musher doing all this rest? Why are they still in the checkpoint? Why have they been there for so many hours? And one thing that everybody needs to remember is along the trail, you have to do two mandatory 8-hour rests. One of them is at White Mountain, and the other one is on the Yukon River. And then you have to do a 24-hour rest at some point along the trail. And most mushers are either doing them now or getting ready to declare their 24 here in the next day or so. And that's a big part of race strategy on when they do it, whether they're going to do it in Nikolai or McGrath or a little bit further down the trail. But that is a required stop where it allows everything to kind of recharge, everything to get back in gear. And that's when the start time differential is factored in and all of that. And, of course, there are some benefits to staying in one checkpoint or another. For example, in McGrath, very well known for the 24-hour rest, and I believe Takotna as well, which is a little bit further down the trail, is supposed to have exceptional food and really good hospitality. And then there's other checkpoints like Iditarod and so forth where there may not be anything going on, and it might be advantageous for a musher to take their 24-hour rest there. So as folks are watching the standings, and if you have access to the tracker on Iditarod Insider or anything like that, you will see over the next day or so just about everybody taking their 24-hour rest. And I'm going to put you on the spot here, Alex. I don't know if you can answer my question, but do you happen to know the latest somebody took a 24-hour rest, and do you know where that was at?
I'm not positive, but I think someone took a 24-hour rest at Iditarod like 5 or 6 years back, and it might have even been at Martin Boozer. There are some mushers who like to take their 24s at a checkpoint that's not very popular. because they just want to make sure that they can get away from the crowds, and they don't want to be with everyone at Takotna or everyone at McGrath.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. And as I said, I'm sitting here without any resources. But I wonder if it's logistically possible if a person could wait and take their 24-hour rest on the Yukon River and include that with their 8-hour rest and have a 36-hour rest, very similar to what they do in the Yukon Quest at Dawson, and be all done at once. I don't know if that's ever happened, but that would be a very interesting strategy to go that far into the race. You're into the second third of the race at that point, and just sort of do everything at once.
Yeah, I'll take a look at the rules after we get off the air. I'm wondering if that's allowed or if they have to be like separate, the 24 and the 8.
Well,
I'm not sure what the answer
tomorrow
is.
We'll let our listeners know tomorrow, and if somebody does know that, please let us know in our Facebook or Twitter feeds or Instagram or wherever you're following the show. Alex, we have about 5 minutes left, and we're under the constraints of being on the radio. That's what makes us a little bit different than other podcasts, our show under 30 minutes. Who are we talking about this evening?
We're talking this evening about Victoria Hardwick, who is our current Red Lantern. And just very briefly before I get into it, I want to correct something I said, I think, yesterday, talking about 24s. I got it reversed. The last musher who finishes takes a 24-hour rest that's exactly 24 hours, and the first one has the time added on. So in this year,
okay,
it's going to be almost 2 hours for the first one. So I apologize for getting that wrong the other day. Victoria Hardwick is currently lives in Bethel, and she is a dentist. She started mushing relatively recently, just 5 years ago. She grew up in the eastern part of Washington State and was one of these people who is very into outdoors activities of all different kinds, grew up riding horses, and she had a neighbor when she was dealing with horses and learning to ride, who had sled dogs and was always intrigued by the idea of sled dogs and mushing. She went to, after college, she went to dental school in Seattle. And then when she was finished with that, she moved out to Alaska to practice dentistry out in the bush. And as you can imagine, when you're outside of a big city, there's a real need for these sort of medical and dental services. And the first year that she was living out in Bethel, she went to the finisher's banquet in Nome, and she was just entranced by hearing the trail stories and meeting a bunch of mushers. She decided that she wanted to get more involved and started asking around if there was anyone who needed a handler. She got a handler position in addition to her dental practice work. A couple of weeks after the mushers banquet, and she said that she just loves the simplicity of the sport of dog mushing, which just takes away a lot of the noise that you have to deal with all the time in everyday life. And it's a very simple thing with your dogs and your dog chores and the trail, and a lot of other things are just kind of fall away when you're concentrating on that. And after she had been handling for a year, she entered her first race, and she said that the first race she was on was only the second time that she'd been on a sled all by herself. And she fell in love with seeing the beauty of Alaska from a dog sled. And, you know, if you've ever ridden a dog sled or even ridden a bike in a very beautiful area, it's a far different experience from driving through somewhere, because you feel like you're going at a speed that's slow enough that you're really part of the environment. And she told the insider that she's planning on taking her 24-hour rest in McGrath, and was very excited when she heard that they have showers at that checkpoint. She said she's making sure that she's drinking a lot of water so she can stay hydrated and do everything that she has to do in order to take care of her dogs. And 2 years ago, before she entered the Kuskokwim 300, she said that she thinks that more people should mush, that it's a wonderful experience and more people should do it, and particularly more women should mush dogs. And so it's great that she is running this year as her rookie race, because this year she really got her wish, at least as far as Iditarod is concerned, because there are a lot of women mushing. And I, you know, we talk a lot about how one of the things that makes dog mushing special is that men and women compete on a completely level playing field. So I think it's really cool that she said that a couple of years ago, and now she's running in this race.
Always an inspiration, especially from those back of the packers. You had said that currently she's in the last place position, in the Red Lantern position, and I'm sure she's running a very conservative race compared to the supersonic speeds of those top mushers, well ahead of her. But it looks like she's doing well. She's working her way down the trail, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that as we progress through our coverage. We seem to mention it every year about sort of that Iditarod machine and how it rolls down the trail and make sure everybody's competitive and everybody's rocking and rolling. And I think that at least at this point, Victoria is doing her job and doing very well on the trail. Alex, we are out of time. I again thank you for being on with me today. I know you're heading back home to LA in just a few hours. You're going to be leaving tonight. Was it another successful trip up here for you for our Iditarod?
Absolutely. It was a really great trip, I was very glad that I came up here, and also it'll be nice to get home.
It's probably a little warmer, even though by Alaska standards it's quite warm up here this week in the big city of Anchorage. Well, you have a safe trip, and we'll talk to you tomorrow, okay?
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Porto for Mushing Radio. Make sure you tell your friends that that we are on every night, and just head over to wherever you're listening to us on your devices and hit that subscribe button. And no matter what time we air our show, you will get it right in your inbox within just a few minutes of us posting the show. So with that, I hope everybody has a good evening, and we'll talk.